Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Isla Meyer-Smith, a global change ecologist, a National Geographic explorer, Chancellor's Fellow, and Chair of the Climate Change Ecology at the University of Edinburgh. Her research examines the greening of the Arctic and how plants are responding to climate warming and impacts, including shrub expansion and permafrost thaw. In this episode, we talk about why the Arctic is warming four times as fast as the rest of the planet, the latest IPCC report and what it means and what we can do, the greening of the Arctic, tipping points, and so much more. I hope you enjoyed this smooth conversation thanks to our sound partner, Audio Technica. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Well, Isla, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. And I'd love to start by you sharing a little bit about your journey and how you ended up studying and researching climate change.
Well, where to start? So I am the child of two biologists. So I guess biology and science was always in my life. But when I was at university, I did a summer job and I was working with a PhD student, and I asked her, like, if she had her academic career over again, what would she do? And she said, I said, go to Alaska. That was very inspirational. I thought, okay, I'm going to go to Alaska. So I ended up doing a master's degree at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And when I was up there, I got the opportunity to go north within Alaska to the Arctic. And I got that first opportunity to sort of cross over the Arctic Circle, go beyond the tree line, the sort of northern extent at which trees grow, and see those sort of vast open plains of tundra landscapes. And I thought, this place is cool. I want to come back here. But I also got to learn about what I still study today, which is how climate change is reshaping those ecosystems, and in particular, how shrubs, which are kind of the trees of the tundra, woody plants, are increasing in tundra landscapes. So this was all, I don't know, more than 20 years ago now. I got that first chance to explore those systems and that question of how is climate change influencing the Arctic piqued my interest. And then I sort of designed my career around that.
Wow, that's so amazing. I love that it stemmed from just a conversation with one person, and then it basically defined your entire career trajectory.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so we're going to circle back to that. But first, I would love for you to explain in your own words how the climate change situation is. Like, what are we really looking at and talking about as it is today?
Yeah, so maybe a place to start is yesterday. So today's the 21st of March, and yesterday the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just released their final report of a series of reports that they've been releasing over the last 2 years. And that report is sort of a synthesis of all we know about climate change to date. And I was involved with the second report and writing about how climate change is impacting the Arctic. And so we've got all this information together of hundreds and hundreds of scientists working around the world on these issues. And the basic headlines are climate change is continuing. It's becoming more rapid, accelerating. And when we think about the Arctic, it's happening even faster up at the northern latitudes of the planet. So when I started working for my master's and my PhD, and I was working on carbon questions, we have these sensors that we use out in the field, and you have to say what the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is to start doing your measurements. And so back then I was putting numbers in that were around 365. And today, if I was to go do those same measurements, I would put the number 400 into the machine. So the concentration of CO2 has been increasing, and also other greenhouse gases. And along with it comes warming at the high latitudes of the planet. And so in more recent years, we used to talk about how the Arctic was warming twice as fast and twice as much as the rest of the planet. And then a few years ago, some climatologist scientists said, oh, maybe we should update that number. It's more like three times as fast. And then just last year, or over the last 2 years, more people were saying, no, we need to update the number again. It's actually four times as fast. So you have this acceleration of climate change for the planet as a whole, but you also have that happening even faster at the high latitudes of the planet. So we're really seeing climate change play out in those Arctic ecosystems that I study right now.
Yeah. And so why is it that it is four times as fast as the rest of the Earth? Maybe an obvious question, but I, just in case.
It's not obvious. I was lecturing to some students yesterday, and I've looked it up in the past, and you could say there's 7 or 8 technical reasons for why that's happening, but I'll give you the short answer today. So we call that process of more warming at high latitudes Arctic amplification. And one of the major reasons for it is the sea ice albedo effect. So if you imagine our planet, at the top of the planet, you have an ocean, the Arctic Ocean, and in the wintertime and for most of the year, there's sea ice over that ocean, so a white surface. But with warming, the sea ice is melting and becoming a smaller area in the summertime, and in the least amount of sea ice is usually in around September. So that extent of sea ice is going down. So the white covering on the top of the planet is getting smaller and smaller. And underneath the sea ice is a dark ocean that's bringing heat, the sun's heat, into the system. And so it's a bit like if you imagine it's a summer day and it's quite hot outside and you have a choice of what outfit to wear and you have a black t-shirt and a white t-shirt, you'd probably go with the white t-shirt because you're going to feel cooler because it's going to reflect the sun's heat, and the black t-shirt, you'll feel the heat on your back. So it's like that for the planet. So we're basically taking the white t-shirt off the Arctic, replacing it with a black t-shirt in the summertime, and that's bringing more heat into the system. And then there's all sorts of other things we could chat about how weather and ocean circulation works, basically in general, because of where there's land and where there's ocean at the northern reaches of our planet, heat is transferred from equatorial latitudes up over the Arctic and cool air is brought down. And so those are some of the patterns that make, say, the UK where I'm based warmer than it otherwise would be, because heat is brought up on the coast of the Atlantic there. Those same processes are meaning that we're sort of having hot air move into the Arctic basin. And so that creates an amplification of the warming as well. And then we can keep going on, but those are some of the really key processes.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think that's very clear, especially the analogy of the white t-shirt versus black t-shirt. I think that makes a lot of sense and is very easy to visualize. So circling back, you brought up the IPCC report, the 6th piece that just came out yesterday. And I really liked the quote that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres shared, that in short, our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once. Very timely quote, obviously, for many reasons, but I would love to just understand a little bit more about what this really means in general. Like, what are the actions that need to happen? Because this is a final warning, this report, you know, it's the last installation that's coming out, and we have until 2030 to cut our emissions and global greenhouse gases by half. So do you think we're on track to achieve that? And what are the main things that we should actually be doing? All of these, everything all at once.
Yeah, I heard it joked on the news that clearly the UN Secretary General was watching the Oscars when he came up with that quote. But I think one thing I'd sort of add to it is that climate change impacts are happening everywhere all at once, but they're happening more severely in certain parts of the world than others. So if you think about us in this conversation and our lives, we may not be feeling the same climate change impacts as other people around the planet. So then it becomes really hard of how do we convince the entire planet, all the governments of the world, all the individual people of the world to take change if they're not feeling those impacts themselves so directly, or not everyone is. And often the people who feel the more severe impacts are not in positions where they can really advocate for change. So yeah, I think it's a huge challenge. I also think it isn't too late for us to take the collective action we need, but every day we delay taking the collective action, the challenge gets harder and harder. So again, it's this tricky balance of how do you keep optimism and motivate people to make change when, because we haven't been doing the things we need to do, the problem's getting worse and worse. I don't have the answers to all these questions. And actually, the IPCC report works with many scientists and social scientists who think about the people side of the problem. And I'm thinking more about the ecology, the biology side of the problem. But yeah, I think ultimately it involves individual actions that we all take as citizens of this planet, but big government actions as well. And it also takes actions from the private sector, from NGOs. We all need to sort of tag team on this to get action. And we have to start somewhere, and anything that makes some improvements to tackling the climate change problem will be of benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all in this together after all, and it's not just individuals. As you said, the government and industry need to play their role and step up as well. So what are some of the actions that you think that businesses or consumers could take to actually reduce their environmental impact?
Yeah, so when I get asked these kind of questions, I often, for the consumer, I think about myself. So we have lots of choices that we're making every day, sometimes an overwhelming number of choices. And so we're thinking about how we get to work, what we eat, how we travel on vacation, what products we buy. And each of those decisions, we can be making a decision that's probably better for the planet or a decision that's not as good for the planet. So trying as much as we can to be making the better decision, I think, is something I do in my life. And I hope all of us can be thinking through that in our own lives. And I think if we all as individuals make small incremental positive change in the right direction, and you add all that change up, then it can make a very big difference. And then if we think of sort of businesses, organizations, governments, there's a role for real leadership, top-down leadership, in sort of paving a way for us to do things differently. And I think one role that the private sector can play is with sort of innovation, really thinking about how can we design products to have less of an impact on the planet. And sometimes that involves really putting money into something that you don't know if it's going to deliver on what you're hoping it will deliver. And not all of our technological solutions to making things consume less energy are going to pan out. But if we keep working on coming up with new ideas, new solutions, some of those solutions will have a pretty big impact. I'm a scientist, so I think technology has a role to play, but we also have to forget that it's or we have to not forget that it's our individual decisions and behaviors and how we vote for the governments that are making decisions that also have impact as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we actually got connected because of the work that Epson's doing with their cooling technology, which I found super fascinating. So I wonder if you could just briefly touch on that.
Yeah, so I got involved with Epson and National Geographic because they're helping to support scientific research and scientific researchers like me. And I also use Epson products in my research. So I particularly work with scanners, and my research team and I are interested in how plants are responding to climate change. And we need to get very high resolution imagery of the leaves of plants and to sort of figure out, are they capturing light in different ways. And so we are scanning plant leaves with Epson scanners, and we need technology that we can take up to the Arctic where we don't have power sources and things. So it was really cool to make that connection to a company that's helping us do the science that we're doing. And Epson is thinking about the impact of the products that they produce in terms of energy consumption. And so they're working towards creating printers and scanners that use less energy. And so if we're all making those kind of changes in terms of the products that we're developing as companies or the products that we as consumers are buying, then hopefully that will make a difference in our energy consumption.
Yeah, no, I really liked the fact that for products that typically have to heat up to be used, they're actually using different technologies and they're, you know, really pushing the cutting edge to cool down, to like have a cooling way of doing that instead. And I think that's, we need more innovation like this to be able to tackle things, as you said, on like all the multi levels that we need to. So let's go back to the work that you're doing then. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the greening of the Arctic is and what is really causing this phenomenon more than what you've shared so far.
Great. So I study the greening of the Arctic. And what we mean by this Arctic greening is to figure out what the impacts of climate change are on the planet across all the ecosystems of the planet. One of the tools we can use are satellites. So satellites are circling the planet, observing what's happening on the ground all over, but particularly in the Arctic. And what satellites have been seeing over decades is that there appears to be a greening of the land surface. So we talked a little bit about sea ice and how sea ice is melting in the Arctic with warming. And what's happening on land is that the snow is melting earlier in the season. The temperatures are warmer during the summer, and that's allowing plants to grow earlier and also grow more across the summer. So we've made this link between what the satellites are seeing from space in terms of a greening on the ground and what's happening on the ground that we see from observations that research teams like my research team, but many other people working all around the Arctic are seeing in terms of plants growing more. But the satellite data they have sort of sensors, like cameras basically on the satellites, but the resolution of those cameras is very, very low. So the way that they see the surface of the planet, at least these satellites that have been up in the air for decades, is very pixelated. So it's a very coarse view of what's happening on the ground. And sometimes, for example, the satellite might see a snow patch melting and perceive that as greening, even if plants aren't increasing on the ground. And other times, plants could be increasing, but the satellites just can't see that because the data are too coarse. So what my group has been doing in recent years is working with drones and other technology to get really high resolution data of the tundra ecosystems that we study up in the Arctic and that change that's going on to link what we see on the ground in little plots that we can monitor by hand to getting information across landscapes that we can then compare to what the satellites are seeing. And if we put all this information together, we can start to get a much more precise understanding of change that's going on around the Arctic, not just where research teams can visit, because that's only a small proportion of this really big, vast biome. But we can also start to make more informed predictions of how climate change and accelerating warming might be influencing these systems in the future.
And so where has the research landed right now? What are the big understandings or things that you're sharing? And what are the predictions that you're seeing moving forward?
Yes, we're seeing a few different things. I alluded to one at the beginning of our conversation, and that's an increase in these woody shrubs. So these shrubs are sort of the trees of the tundra. They're the biggest plants around, and they seem to grow more in warmer summers. And we know that from watching them take over landscapes, but also if you cut down any of these woody plants in these high latitude ecosystems, you can see rings. If you can imagine a piece of wood and there's rings in the wood, that's the winter or the summer growth is the lighter part of the wood. And then those dark lines is when the growth stops in winter for that tree. And so you can see how much that plant grew each summer and you can link that to the climate. So when we do those kind of analyses, we see these shrubs grow more in warmer summers. So the shrubs are growing better now that things are in general warming more up in the Arctic. We're also seeing changes in other plants. So we often see more grasses and we see sort of mixed responses for things like mosses and lichens, the sort of smaller plants that are often being shaded out by more shrubs and grasses above them. And overall, we're seeing more plants across these landscapes than we saw in the past. So plants are growing where they didn't used to grow before. So there really is this greening signal on the ground, that same signal that we're picking up from satellites, but we just want to have a better, more precise understanding of the rates of change and how that links to temperature change and other processes going on in these systems.
Mm. And so what is permafrost and how big a role is this playing in the work that you do or, you know, the greening of the Arctic? Maybe you can explain why we should be worried about it.
Yeah. So we talked about the plants and the plants are really just this like super thin layer sitting on top of these frozen soils. And that's what we're referring to as permafrost. So the official definition is permafrost is any soil that stays or any part of the ground that stays frozen for 2 years in a row. But a lot of permafrost in the Arctic has been frozen for thousands and thousands of years. And now as things warm, those permafrost soils are starting to thaw. So I work at site on the Arctic coast of the Yukon Territory. It's called Kikiktaarik. So if you imagine the top of the planet and you imagine where Alaska is and where Canada is, just where the two meet, that's pretty much where this site that I work at is located. And in that region of the Arctic, the ground is really ice rich. So if you were to sort of look below the plants, you would see huge chunks of ice in the ground and the whole ground is frozen. So in some areas, it's like 90% ice and only 10% soil. And so if something happens, like a little disturbance, like maybe a little stream knocks a piece of the ground away, then that exposes that ice and it starts to melt. And then the next summer, more melting will occur, more permafrost will get exposed, and that feature will grow and grow and grow across the landscape. And that forms what we call retrogressive thaw slumps, but we'll just call them thaw slumps for short here. And they basically look like giant bites out of the tundra, these big sort of cliff faces with a cesspool of mud below. So there's some really big, impressive retrogressive thaw slumps out at this site and all along that coastline in the Arctic and also across the coastline of Alaska and in the very far east of Siberia. And so this is where some of the most active permafrost thaw is happening. And just to give you a feel, this the biggest slump on the island where I work, it's called Slump D, a very exciting name. If you stand at the top of it, you've got a 40 meter, so something around 50, 60 foot cliff below you of exposed ice right now. And so every summer that's growing bigger and bigger. And as the permafrost is thawing, it's releasing carbon to the atmosphere. So you have that kind of really dramatic permafrost thaw going on, but you also have a more, less dramatic type of thaw, which is that the top layers of the soil are just thawing deeper each summer now. So we call that top layer the active layer. And as the soils thaw deeper, that gives plant roots more space to grow and more nutrients that they can use. So there's this link between the permafrost thawing and the plants above. And I'll just give you one more sort of piece in the puzzle there. If you have things like more shrubs sitting on top of the permafrost, in the wintertime, the snow is blowing around in these ecosystems and the shrubs will actually trap the snow in and so make a deeper layer of snow. And it's a bit like if you're in a cold place like Scotland in the winter, you want to have as many blankets on top of you as possible to stay warm when you're sleeping or whatever. It's just like that in the tundra with the thickness of the blanket, the snow. If you have a thick blanket of snow, the ground underneath stays warmer in the winter. So if you have more shrubs in these systems, you get a thicker blanket of snow, and then that keeps the soils warmer, which means the next summer, once the snow's melted, they'll thaw faster. So we have this positive feedback between the plants changing how the system insulates the soils, and then that leading to more thaw. So when we think about permafrost thaw in these ecosystems, we're quite concerned because about a third of the world's soil carbon is found up in these Arctic ecosystems. And if all of that soil carbon were lost to the atmosphere, it would more than double the atmospheric concentration of CO2. So if you imagine the concentration of CO2 we have right now, 400 parts per million of CO2, it would be 800 or more if we let that carbon out of these permafrost soils at high latitudes. And as plants are changing, that's changing that dynamic. So there's lots of work to be done to figure out what's coming for us if climate change keeps accelerating in these systems.
Yeah, that's really scary. I mean, it's already looking quite bad at the moment, and a doubling just from the warming and the thawing of permafrost. I mean, that's pretty scary. How, like, to get to that doubling level, like, what are the current models? Like, how far in advance do they predict that this would actually happen? Like, how far away are we for that point?
I think the honest answer is we don't totally know. And that's part of the reason that it's hard to, yes, stimulate action, is because we have these sort of unknowns about how quickly some of these processes might happen. And so maybe you've heard about tipping points, this sort of idea that the change isn't just linear, and it's not even just exponential, but you could be going along on a certain trajectory and then enough of the system changes and then you end up in a whole new system. So that can happen with things like permafrost thaw, because you have ground that's sitting frozen, but it's very close to the threshold at which it could thaw out. So if things continue as they are now, that period is probably many hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years in the future. But if things accelerate, that period comes sooner. And then if we cross a tipping point, it comes even sooner. And we don't know what will lead us to cross many of the sort of climate tipping points that are potentially out there.
Mm. What is it that gets you most excited about this work? Like, I can see and hear your passion as you're just explaining it, but what is it that really drives you?
As a scientist, I think I'm driven by curiosity. And it's interesting to be a climate change scientist because, you know, some of the facts and figures and things we've been talking about are quite depressing as well. But yeah, I am driven by trying to figure out the answers to questions. And in my research group, we talk about the idea of a data present. So this is when you have a scientific question and you've gone out and collected all the data, and then you've finally been able to analyze it. And that moment when you suddenly have the answer to the question that maybe you've been working on for like 4 or 5 years, there's this joy when you're suddenly like, aha, it is this number, or it's a yes or it's a no. So that, as a scientist, drives me. But I think one way to sort of deal with the climate anxiety that goes along with some of these big, scary topics like Arctic climate change is to really focus on educating yourself and learning about the system and learning about the people who live in the Arctic and their perspectives. And for me, that learning and listening to others and thinking about the future generations who will be living in these Arctic ecosystems and what they want to do about climate change helps give me optimism and pushes me forward to keep collecting the data, analyzing the data, and trying to find incrementally a better understanding of how climate change is impacting the Arctic.
Yeah, I think people and stories are so important as part of this journey. And as you said, to not completely lose yourself in the doom and gloom of it all. So what are some of the inspiring stories or things that you've learned from those groups and from the next generation who live in the Arctic?
Yeah, I'm very lucky to get the opportunity to work at this Kikiktaark site because it's also a territorial park. And I get to be there with Inuvialuit people who manage that ecosystem, and we get to participate in this collaboration. It's my research group. It's researchers from the Alfred Wegener Institute in Germany, and then it's the park rangers, and then it's anyone who's visiting the island. And the head park ranger, Richard, and I have chatted about. Richard has this very welcoming perspective about the island, and he says it's our island. It's everyone's island. It's the Inuvialuit who are managing it. But for everyone who gets to step foot on that island, you learn something from those ecosystems, and hopefully you can give back to maintaining those ecosystems for the future. And recently we've got the opportunity to work with youth from those regions and to teach them about the science that we're doing and to encourage them on career paths that it might be being a scientist, but it might be being a communicator in some other way or learning the stories of their elders and sharing that with the next generation. So I think there's many different ways to be involved. And yeah, it's definitely not all about me. And I'm really excited about the next generation of scientists and northerners who are going to be facing more of the impacts, but hopefully also stimulating more of the solutions as well.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And so given everything that you know and the work that you do, are you hopeful for the future and our survival on this planet?
I have hope, yes. I think we can't ever give up on issues like this. And I think that, like with anything, it's about taking small incremental steps and making progress in the right direction. And I think humans have an amazing capacity to act collectively when we put our collective brains to doing that. And so maybe we're still in that stage of trying to figure out how we actually all work together on this big issue. But the science is there. And we have the latest IPCC reports. Us scientists are going to keep working on the details and try and get more information about what's coming. But now it's time to transition over to societies and governments and everyone to sort of take the action that we need.
Definitely. Action is such a big part. And I really hope we do get to that point soon when we can all put our brains together and take collective action for the planet and for our survival. So I hope that happens sooner rather than later. Do you have, like, if you're having a particularly challenging day or, you know, you've just, I don't know, sometimes you go maybe in and out of eco-anxiety or whatever. Are there any practices that you draw on to sort of get you through?
This is a good question. Being an academic can be a very challenging job. So you're given a lot of freedom to pursue what interests you most, to pick the research that you want to do. But along with that, you're also given lots of responsibilities. You're teaching students, you're supervising graduate students, you're organizing Arctic field research programs, you're trying to write papers. There's all these competing asks on your time. And certainly some days I can't really cope with it all. I guess one of the things that I try and do is to find time to just relax and not take the world on my shoulders, I guess. And so sometimes that's taking a bath, going for a walk, reading a book, sometimes an escapist book that isn't about learning more. It's about just pretending that the world's troubles don't exist. So giving your brain a little break from the stresses of a job and also the stresses of the impacts we're having on the planet. And then hopefully you refresh and you're able to tackle the challenges the next day.
Yeah, I think that's a really great one. Having a break and finding different ways, different things that help you to do that. Different tools is great. How do you think that we can live wide awake?
Yeah, and I think sort of paralleling the comments I just made, there's this maybe tension between we want to like fully be aware of everything that's going on this planet, the impacts that we're having. But at the same time, you can get inundated with that knowledge and you can end up in a sort of negative space. So in my own life, at least, I'm trying to find this balance between really thinking about every action I take, trying to do the right thing for the planet, for other people around me, but at the same time, not allowing myself to get overwhelmed by all of those decisions and overwhelmed by the impacts that I'm having. And often for me, it's about sort of centering myself back with my community around me. So whether that's in my scientific community, the students who I mentor, or the colleagues that I work with, or whether that's my literal community around me, my neighbors, my family, my friends. And again, getting that energy from other people that then I can put back into the work that I do and the challenges that I have. So yeah, I think it's a balancing act. It's a little bit like the science we were talking about at the beginning. You have energy flowing around ecosystems and you have energy flowing in and out of yourself. And so sometimes the energy can get depleted when you're working in challenging areas like climate change science, and you have to find ways to replenish that energy so you can keep doing the work that you do and taking the next step forward.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. We've got to find our little energy sources so that we can keep going. Well, thank you so much for sharing and for joining us today. It was really clear. I think people have a generalization of scientists that they struggle to be able to communicate things clearly, but you do not have that problem. It was very clear and I loved all the analogies. I deeply appreciated those. So thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. I think sometimes people forget scientists, we're just real people too. So yeah.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Ayla. Firstly, if you're ever feeling overwhelmed or lost in the doom and gloom, focus on educating yourself and listening to the stories and actions of others. Secondly, scientists have been working and researching and taking action for years to give us the information that we need about climate change. Now it is time to transition to society and for all of us to take action. So thirdly, we have the amazing ability to act when we put our collective brains together, and small incremental steps is where we can all start and focus. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Stephel Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.